Hello and welcome to New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. I'm your host, Mark Locks. Today we're talking to Professor Riaz Hassan about his new book, Suicide Bombings. This is a shortcuts version by Routledge of his longer book, Life as a Weapon. As you'll hear in the interview, Professor Hassan has done a great deal of research on the field of suicide bombing and did so as part of a research grant that he received from the Australian Research Council. I found this book absolutely fascinating. I've done a lot of work on terrorism myself and I learnt an enormous amount from the work that Professor Hassan has done. So without further ado, please enjoy the interview. Welcome to New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. I'm Mark Locks, your host, and today we're talking to Professor Riaz Hassan about his book, Suicide Bombings. Hello, Riaz. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Mark.
That's good. And you're in Singapore at the moment, is that correct?
I am, yes.
Yes. Right. And normally you're at Flinders University in Australia?
Yes. That's right. I'm an emeritus professor at Flinders. I have been there for close to 37 years.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. Right. Just to get started, I suppose if you could just tell us a bit of your own personal history and how you came to actually be writing a book about suicide bombers.
No. My interest in suicide bombing and this topic in general actually is related to my interest in suicide and why people suicide in human societies. And I have been working on the study of suicide for almost, you know, most of my academic life, which is about 45 years, and published extensively in that, including probably the only book on suicide in Australia, Suicide Explained, which came out about 15 years ago. So I was interested in basically understanding how suicide bombing and suicide in general actually, you know, differ. And that's what was the primary motivation or intellectual sort of curiosity that got me going.
Wonderful, wonderful. And you ended up getting an Australian Research Council grant.
That's right. I then applied in 2004 for an Australian research grant to study this phenomenon of suicide bombing. And that time, it was the pre-Iraq period, you see. I mean, the Iraq war had just started, and I was interested in, you know, what has been going on over the last 25 years. And I applied for the grant, and I was very fortunate. I was successful. I got a grant for 5 years, which included a professorial fellowship. And it commenced in 2005, and I began to start working on my research project. And then 2005, in July, excuse me, the new counterterrorism laws became effective in Australia.
Right. And they had an influence on your research.
That, under the provision of those laws, the conduct and the treason provisions, you know, they are so broad that you can drive a truck through them. Mm. Basically, half of my research, which involved interviewing terrorist organization and people who have been incarcerated for attempted suicide bombing and their sponsors, that became illegal. I then sought an interview with the then Attorney General, Mr. Philip Ruddick, to get an exemption. He refused that. He said, no, you have to follow the law. And so I just had the option either to abandon the research or continue with it. So I then decided to continue with it. I changed my methodology. Instead of interviewing terrorist organization and the terrorist themselves, those who had been at least arrested or those I could have access to, I then changed the focus and I started collecting data from by interviewing counterterrorism police and the journalist. Though I must mention, I just go back a little bit, the research had two main sources of data. One was the secondary source, and that secondary source was actually going to come from the published record or published reports on suicide bombing in the last 25 years. and I already had access to a database from Chicago, University of Chicago, and mm-hmm. also from Nuffield College at Oxford. I had some data, access to data, and I was going to update that to 2004 and 2005, and then supplement, complement that research data with primary data, which I was going to collect from terrorist organization, and that the part that I had to abandon, and change my focus by interviewing terrorism officers, police, and security people, counterterrorism security establishment, and the journalists. So basically, my research in Australia was the first one to be affected by counterterrorism laws, and at that time, the government did not give me exemption.
Right, right. And you are actually working at a center for studying suicide bombing, is that correct, at Flinders University?
No, I actually started the...
Oh, you started it, right.
I more or less started the research project mm-hmm. studying for suicide bombing because unlike some of the other universities, you know, Flinders University is, as you know, relatively smaller universities compared to some of the more, group of eight universities. So getting resources to set up a center was very difficult. So, but basically, I research funded my salary and a part-time research assistant. So basically, it was myself and a part-time research assistant and the collaboration that I, a group of people that I was basically in touch internationally who have been working in this research on this topic, and also people I was meeting in five countries that I chose where 90% of suicide bombing had occurred. And they were, by the way, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Palestinian territories, and Israel. But right. the problem that I encountered when I started research, there were 315 suicide attacks globally until the end of 2003. Now, I assume, based on that, I said that we're probably looking at another 50 or 60 suicide attacks in the 2004, and I would then begin to, and probably the same number in 2005, and that's the time when I was going to then start writing my findings. But then Iraq War basically changed
yes.
the whole global scenario as far as suicide bombing attacks were concerned, and I can give you an example. Between 1981 and 2003, there were 315 suicide bombing. And in Iraq alone, between 2004, starting, you know, in May 2003, when the invasion began, to 2007, there were 847 suicide bombing.
Wow.
So in Iraq alone, there were more suicide bombing, in fact, 300 times more than there were in the whole world in the previous 25 years.
Wow.
And result of that was that my research became actually far more extensive and time-consuming than I had anticipated.
Yes.
This is something, if you're doing research, you know, you don't expect this kind of, you know, change to occur. But you just imagine that I was looking at analyzing 350 or 400 suicide bombing attacks, and I ended up in at least analyzing my database close to 1,200 suicide bombing attacks.
Wow. That's quite amazing. And it's interesting, you actually start the book talking about the definition of what a suicide bombing is.
Yes.
Because there's not a single, like anything in academia, there's very rarely a single agreed definition.
Yes. Well, exactly, because you have to define, if you're collecting the data, even secondary or primary data, you have to define, obviously, what is the nature of the incident, you know, that you are going to analyze. And as you can see, I have gone through quite, I went to great length to describe, you know, phenomenon of suicide bombing. I think basically I started off by saying suicide bombing is self-destructive humans, you know, who use their life for political purposes.
Right.
A political end. There was a relatively, you know, fairly straightforward definition. And as soon as I started research, I found that that was not sufficient. So I then described in some detail, I think there's a whole paragraph which actually describes my definition of suicide bombing, because every suicide attack, which I then included in my database, had to meet the requirements of my definition. Mm. Consequently, some databases for the same period would have, for example, RAND Corporation had fewer suicide bombing than I had. Other, like START, had more suicide bombing because of the definitional differences. But I'm quite confident that I think my definition is probably closer to at least what I would regard sociologically acceptable, a description of the phenomenon.
Yes, yes. And do you include the 9/11 attack as a suicide bombing?
They are, indeed. I mean, then the issue is whether suicide bombing incidents, when multiple people are involved, so there are two set of variables in mind. There's a suicide bomber, mm-hmm. an individual, and then suicide bombing attacks.
Right.
So the 9/11 would be an example, which was suicide bombing attacks carried out by multiple suicide bombers.
Right.
So while they still remain the most lethal suicide, they were only in my database, they are counted as 3 suicide attacks, but they are the most lethal. The minimum number of killed, I think the same, 2,988, mm-hmm. remained the most lethal attacks as far as the statistics are concerned.
So you're counting each plane as a separate attack?
Each is a separate attack, although there were 19 suicide bombers involved in four, but one was not one basically crashed. Mm. One plane crashed, and so the 3, basically 2 in the World Trade Center and 1 in Pentagon, are counted as a separate incident. So I have 3. I've counted them as 3.
Right, right. And a lot of people around the world would associate suicide bombing with Islamic terrorism. Did you find that that is a fairly accurate description, or is it far more widespread than that?
I think that's much more a media construction. Certainly, the common discourse on suicide bombing is that these are driven by Muslim fundamentalists. Mm. And my research, which more or less confirms, is confirmed by other people like Robert Pape and Diogo Gambetta and a number of other people who have been working, a handful of us who have been working on this area, that Islam really is, the motivating factor is not religion, it's politics.
Right.
And essentially, it's, if I can just give you my, the summary or synopsis of my findings.
Definitely.
Suicide bombing, as a weapon, as a phenomena occurs, is part of endemic, intractable conflicts between state and non-state actors over dispossession, citizenship rights, and occupation.
Right. I mean, occupation of a country.
Occupation of the country or territory.
Yes.
See, it doesn't have to be a separate country, but it could be territory like in Sri Lanka, like a country, for example, in Afghanistan, or, and then in Palestine. So in Iraq, it was the occupation. So dispossession, occupation, and citizenship rights. They all intertwine, but they are the three key sort of descriptors. And they're part of endemic, intractable conflict. That, in other words, they have been going on and been no resolution. The second stage is that it is state-sponsored violence against the non-state actors. Is the second stage. And the third stage is with the non-state actors that improvise weapons and retaliate. The suicide bombing occur at the second stage. Endemic conflicts, first endemic conflicts, second one, state-sponsored violence against the state-sponsored violence or state-sanctioned violence against non-state actors, and then the response of the non-state actors. In the third stage, the suicide bombings occur.
Right. And
religion becomes part of the whole cocktail of motivation, but it is not the driving force.
Okay. I'm actually looking in your book at the moment, and there's a very long list of the number of countries that suicide bombings have actually occurred in. Now, obviously, Iraq's at the top as far as the number of incidents, but I think there's over 20 countries listed here, which most people would not be aware that that's the case. Right.
Yeah.
And
Well, they were, in my database, there were about 1,200 incidents in 29 countries, but 90% of them have occurred in Iraq, Israel, Palestinian territory, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and Afghanistan.
Right. And it might be interesting to talk about Sri Lanka, because not as many people will be aware of what's happening there and the rise of suicide bombing with the Tamil Tigers.
Well, as you know, and hopefully most of your listeners will know, that Sri Lanka is an ethnically diverse society. And the two main ethnic groups there are Sinhalese and Tamil. And the Tamils have been in Sri Lanka. There are two kinds of Tamil groups. So Tamil who have been in Sri Lanka for a long time, for 400-500 years, and then Tamils who were brought in during the colonial occupation, colonization, you know, in order to work on the tree plantations. And until about 1940s, 50s, during the colonial British colonial period, Tamils were actually, you know, they had educational, their educational achievement, participation in the public service and private sector was actually quite significant. And then after the independence, the Sinhalese government began to privilege Sinhala language and culture. And that's when thus equality of citizenship was the main issue. So Tamil began to agitate for equality of citizenship. And they actually started first by protesting. They started the political, usually the process always in this conflict, the process develops first by agitation, you know, by protest, by mobilization of people, then formation of political parties, then election into parliament. And when nothing works, then the violence begins. So this is the same history this book we are talking about is the abridged version of the larger study called Life as a Weapon, The Global Rise of Suicide Bombing. And in that book, there are five countries that I have studied as case studies, and Sri Lanka is one of them. And these five countries are where 90% of suicide bombings have occurred. And so in each case, I detail the history of the conflict and how the conflict began, how it was, and how people mobilized themselves politically, socially, you know, through parliamentary election. But when nothing worked, then the conflict became violent. And in the case of Sri Lanka, in the 80s, a Tamil Tiger group emerged in Jaffna, and they began to then respond to suicide bombing. The way I have traced the history, the suicide bombing began in the modern period, because I think, as I point out in my brief introduction, that suicide bombing suicide missions have been part of human history.
Yes.
And you can actually go back to the Roman period, you can go back to Jewish occupation, the Roman occupation of Jerusalem, and the Israeli sect of Sicari, you know, carried out suicide mission.
Mm-hmm.
You can go into in the 12th century, the Shia in the northern Iraq and Iran carried out they have come to known as assassins. You know, they were the
yes.
people who carried out for 150 years. And then, of course, in more recent years, we have the kamikaze pilots in Japan. And so there is a long history through, you know, which in human history, the people have used life in order to, for political purposes, to advance a cause which they believed was right and just. And one doesn't agree with those, you know, with that, but that's how they actually saw their cause. And
yes.
then in the modern period, which begins in 1981, in my research, the suicide bombing began in Lebanon, and Hezbollah were the main perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were picked up as a weapon by Sri Lankan Tamils, who then actually refined the suicide vest as a weapon. They were responsible, and then they transferred it back to the Middle East. The
right.
interesting thing is that while we are talking about it, Hezbollah started it in 1981, and they carried out suicide attacks for about, I think, 10, 11 years. The numbers vary, but it is around, but you know, less than 20. I think close to 12 or 13. But once they became an organized army, they had weapons, they have army. They stopped suicide bombing.
So they didn't need to use suicide bombing anymore,
because they were no longer the weaker party in a conflict. You know, they actually could fight. So, and that's what Israel found out in 2006 and 2007. They actually were a fighting army. Now, as soon as they became, they had access to weapons and they could fight, the suicide bombing stopped.
Right.
But if you take on the other side, between 1979 and 1989, the Taliban, what they known Mujahideen, they fought the Russian army, one of the most powerful Russian armies in the world at that time, in Afghanistan, during the Russian occupation, the USSR, Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And in the 10 years they fought, there was not a single suicide bombing against the Soviets. But once the Soviets departed, and the Americans pulled out and stopped giving resources to these Mujahideen, then they were left on their own. So after 1989, you get the rise of suicide bombing, because once the party becomes weaker, so in the case of Hezbollah, they were a weaker party, they became strong, and they stopped it. In the case of Taliban and Mujahideen in Afghanistan, they were a strong party because they were funded by the United States, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia to fight the Russians. Once the Russians left, all the resources were withdrawn, and basically now, and then as they became a weaker party, after the United States and the U.S. invaded again Afghanistan, the suicide bombing began.
Right. So it is really a weapon they use when there's no other weapon available.
Weapon of the weak. Weapon of the weak in asymmetrical conflicts, political conflicts.
Right. And what about the suicide bombers themselves? You've got some fascinating information about the psychology of the people who actually carry out the attacks, and how they're actually, I don't know if recruited is the right word, but how they're psychologically prepared to actually carry out the attack.
Yeah, I think it one of the findings on my research is that really, if you're looking for a global explanation of recruitment and motivation, you're probably not going to find one single motivating recruitment, you know, sort of factor. It is determined by the conflict.
Right.
In Sri Lanka, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, Iraq, and in Palestinian territories, there are differences.
Yeah.
And these differences I attribute to the nature of conflict. For example, in Sri Lanka, the suicide bombing, the Tamil Tiger was an organized force, and the Black Tigers, the suicide bombers, were the one who actually volunteered to carry out the missions. And they were basically motivated by nationalism and the commitment to the cause, and some people will argue to the leader, Prabhakaran. But they were young male, mostly, and there were few females as well. And they were selected, and then they were trained, just like the armies will train SAS soldiers.
Yep.
In the case of Afghanistan, the recruitment is not as sophisticated, and there's a whole range of factors, and I think I detailed some in my larger book in Life as a Weapon and a study. And you can see it in terms of the outcomes. The lethality of suicide attack, for example, is very high. The number of people killed in a suicide attack globally is about 12, whereas in a non-suicide terrorist attack, the lethality is 1. So the suicide bombing attack is 12 times more lethal. But in Palestine and in Iraq and in Sri Lanka, the average was close to between 9 and 12. But in 42% of suicide bombing attack in Afghanistan, kill only one person, and that's a suicide bomber.
And all right.
So basically, it depends on the training, motivation, and recruitment pattern. And I think they are becoming more sophisticated in Afghanistan now. But certainly, if you look at Iraq, many people who came and became were radicalized and became part of the resistance or the what the Iraqi will call insurgents, or what we will call insurgents, they were actually not religious people. They were basically radicalized by the conflict. And I, there's one instance. There's a small town, Dara, in eastern Libya, which is a population of about 100,000 or 200,000, and it has sent something like 57 people from that little town to Iraq war, and many of them became suicide bombers. This information comes from the data that I received from that became available through the U.S. Army, because insurgent camp was near the Syrian border was discovered and invaded, and once they found the documents they found, they actually surprised the Americans that so many Libyans were involved in that. And when I traced some of the people back to their hometown, they were not really very religious people, but they were radicalized, and they were infuriated, angered, humiliated by the American invasion and what they were watching on particularly after the Abu Ghraib episode. I think that radicalized a lot of people. And in fact, in my study, I showed that in after the Abu Ghraib photographs were published in the New Yorker and became globally viewed, the suicide bombing attacks increased dramatically in Iraq. And it was not the religion, but it was the humiliation. And I have a number of factors that I attribute as the motivating factors, as you probably have seen. And I start with occupation, that they are not psychologically impaired. Suicide bombing are not psychologically impaired. They are just as normal as other people are, from the evidence that we have. It's a strategic weapon used by a weaker party in a political conflict. It's driven by politics, not by religion. And the other factors which have profound effect on creating a culture of suicide bombing is humiliation, retaliation and revenge, and I think finally altruism.
On the part of the bomber?
On the part of the bomber. They basically are doing it because they say, well, if they sacrifice their life, it will deliver in future a better, it will deliver honor and better life for the community.
Right. So, in a sense, it would be unlikely that somebody living in a democracy, even an imperfect democracy, where they had opportunities to complain, opportunities to take action, in a political way, would not look towards suicide bombing as an option.
Well, if it's successful.
Yes, but right. Sorry.
Successful.
Yes.
I mean, if you take, for example, the case of, if you're looking at the conflict, it's not suicide bombing, but the terrorism. If you take the conflict in Great Britain, so long as the terrorism was confined to Northern Ireland, the Americans, the British did not really think it fit to really negotiate with IRA. Mm-hmm. As soon as the conflict came to London and to the mainland, the British said, okay, let's negotiate. I think the political lesson of that is that suicide bombings tend to be more successful when carried out against democracy, because people can then influence the political outcome through elections, forcing the politicians to work out a negotiated settlement.
Right.
So in democracies, in the initially, I think some people have argued that suicide bombing are more effective against democratic regime, which actually provide mechanism for citizens to force the government to change policies to work out a compromise.
Mm.
But then, of course, what happened in Iraq, you can argue that Iraqis were actually carrying on suicide bombing was to change the public opinion in the United States. So that's a matter of your own, in Afghanistan, mm. or in Pakistan, and in Sri Lanka. So one can actually argue that there are skeletons of, there are some, the basis for this position that political scientists hold, that suicide bombings tend to be more effective against democracies, because democracies provide mechanism for people to force the government to change policies, mm. whereas they're not very effective against dictatorship. I mean, nobody will dispute that Saddam Hussein was a very brutal dictator. Mm. But he certainly did not have, there were no suicide bombing against him.
Yes, because there was no way that it would produce an outcome.
That's right.
Right.
But the Americans occupied, and of course, and I think the most telling example is, you might remember, the first suicide bombing occurred in 2000, against in Beirut, against the peacekeepers, American and French peacekeepers in the Lebanese Civil War.
Yes.
And the truck bomb driven by Hezbollah suicide bombers actually blew up the camp and killed 250, close to 300, mostly American peacekeepers. And President Reagan immediately withdrew the whole force. So it was a very successful outcome as far as the Hezbollah were concerned. And so there is this aspect. And of course, there's an aspect of humiliation and retaliation which goes on. But I think generally speaking, ultimately, if you want to stop suicide bombing, you have to find the resolution to the conflict which has given rise to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that invariably will lead to some, that resolution will lead to the cessation of suicide bombing. The second thing which can help is this: the breeding ground of suicide bombings are the refugee camps and the treatment of people in prisons in these conflict zones.
Mm.
And if you can actually humanize treatment of prisoners or insurgents in prisons, and get rid of at least reduce the number of people living in camps, I think it could have very major impact on reducing the number of suicide bombings.
So in Australia at the moment, for example, we've got an ongoing debate about the number of refugees that are being taken by the government through various means. So actually, a greater intake of refugees by countries would contribute towards reducing suicide bombing by reducing the number of people in camps. Is that a long call, or?
Well, it's a long call, but I think my impression is that many of these people are, of course, they are detained because they have broken Australian law. But certainly, to the extent these refugees are coming in from conflict zone, it would have from the sending countries, it would have a positive effect in the sense of a reduced conflict. Mm. In
right,
the region,
right.
But the other side, we are basically looking at the asylum seeker phenomena as creating security risk, which I think is nonsense, because they are fleeing from very conflict-ridden situations, and I think our description of these people as potential terrorists is rather far-fetched, and I think, obviously, I don't have the information that the security agencies would have, intelligence agencies, but my research shows that the terrorist risk does not increase just because the refugees come into a country.
Yeah.
I wouldn't really, in other words, you know, terrorism is a crime.
Mm.
And I think one has to frame it as a crime. And there is absolutely no way to predict that it is it's going to go up or down just because we have more refugees.
No. And really, then suicide bombing could occur anywhere in the world then if the right circumstances arise. So there could be disputes, just as no one was predicting the disputes that were happening in the Middle East 20 years ago. There could be disputes somewhere else in the world that could also lead to the circumstances that promote suicide bombing.
Well, I've given you the three preconditions: an endemic conflict over dispossession, occupation, and political rights between state and non-state actors. The second stage, when the state begins to sanction or initiate violence against the non-state actors, the weaker party, and then the weaker party responds to it.
Yes. So regardless of cultural location, those things could reoccur.
Absolutely.
Right. And are you continuing with the study? Are you going to be expanding it in the future?
Well, no, because I think the resources, ideally it would be desirable that we could build on the work that I have done.
Mm.
And I actually, I'm the only one in Australia, to the best of my knowledge, you know, apart from whatever information the ACO and some of the other defense agencies may have. But I'm the only one academic who actually have collected this extensive data. And I would have been happy for this to become, you know, a sort of nucleus for ongoing research on the topic, but none of the agencies that are interested in either the this federal government or the defense security agencies have shown much interest in doing it. And obviously, you know, if they want to do it, my data is there. And they, and I think the best thing is that I know that there is a surveillance which is continuing in Australia on just to promote security in, of Australian society. And that surveillance is carried out by the Commonwealth government agencies. And but they basically, you know, are secretive and what you call intelligence, you know, agencies. They don't want to make these things public. But I think there should be a location, you know, there should be center for study of, and Macquarie University started it, but they actually just have counter, you know, terrorism. I don't know how effective it is now. You have to look into it. But I was sort of disappointed that after all the work that I've done, basically the project ended because I stopped, you know, the ARC grant ended after 5 years.
Right.
Neither my university, not ARC, was prepared, or anybody else was prepared to either own it or let it go on and develop on it.
It's a terrible shame. Have you had any interest from people overseas in the research?
I get requests from a whole range of people from time to time for data, access to database. And I was getting that even when I was working on my research. The problem is that I was one of the department research assistants.
Mm.
Once my grant ended, I just couldn't spend my time servicing requests for providing people access to database and, you know, a whole range of things that go with it. I could probably set up a research site. That was something I explored. But then somebody had to look after that, you know, a website.
Yes.
So I would put my data on the web. And I couldn't find any support for that. So
right.
What I did, I basically published my data as an appendix to my book, Life as a Web.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So if anybody wants to have access to my data, they can actually get the book, Life as a Weapon, Global Rise of Suicide Bombing, which was published in 2010. And the last, and the appendix A actually contains all the information of suicide attacks on which my book is based, there are 1,200 of them.
Wow. Well, hopefully somebody does at least pick that up. Well, what are you working on at the moment?
This research project I'm now working on is the South Asian Islam, because increasingly the general picture we get in the media is that that's Islam is the majority of the people, majority of the Muslims are Arabs.
Mm.
But actually, there are 1.5 billion, 1.6 billion Muslims as of today in the world, as of end of last year in the world, and 1.2 billion of them live in Asia.
Ah.
And only 300,000 Muslims actually live in the Arabic Middle East.
Wow.
So 1.2 billion Muslims actually live in Asia, and of 1.2 billion, over half a billion live in South Asia.
Mm.
In other words, one out of three Muslims actually live in South Asia, and the other Asian centers, Southeast Asia, that's mostly Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, and then Central Asia. So there's 25% of in South Asia, 25% in Central Asia, Southeast Asia. So I'm basically looking at the diversity of Islam in South Asia, because this again, the idea that Muslim world is a uniform block universe, everywhere the same, and that of course is not the case. And this research I'm doing now is extension of my research which I've done before I worked on suicide bombing, which was again funded by Australian Research Council, for which I'm very grateful. That research was on Muslim religiosity, and I studied 7 countries, Indonesia, Pakistan, Malaysia, Iran, Turkey, Egypt, and Kazakhstan.
Mm.
And the two books were published. I published two books, one, Faith Lines, in 2002, which was published by Oxford, and Inside Muslim Minds, which was published by Melbourne University Press 2 years ago, or 2008, actually.
Mm.
And I'm basically now extending it to include just Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan.
Right. Well, I've been reading a book about Afghanistan recently, and the range of different permutations of Islam and just cultural differences within the Islamic community inside Afghanistan is just astounding. Exactly. It's sort of like every century for the last 3,000 years has left a little cultural group in that particular location. Now all of them are Islamic, but they've all carried millennia of history with them to create these different interpretations of how they're approaching the religion. Yeah. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I think the general view is that some in the picture, among the West, at least in the West, and the general public thinks that it is the Muslim theology which drives the Muslim to behave in a particular way.
Mm.
And what I'm trying to argue, my research, and in fact, it shouldn't come as a surprise to you or any other social scientist, that religion is not an independent variable. It's a dependent variable. In
yes.
other words, religion is influenced by political, social, and economic environment, broader political, social, economic environment, and then it is influenced by gender, age, class, and education.
Mm.
And basically, what I'm trying to investigate how the broader political and social arrangement in these countries influence religious behaviors and religious phenomena, expression of religiosity, and how then micro variables like gender, age, class, and life cycle influence further how religion is expressed and practiced and mobilized for public action or private action.
Right. Absolutely fascinating work. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today. You have been listening to Professor Riaz Hassan talking about his new book, Suicide Bombings, published by Routledge in 2011. I'm your host, Mark Locks, and I will talk to you again next time on New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime.